This is the coronavirus update interview of September 25th, 2021 on Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. I'm your host, Jamie Newton. My guests are Dr. Jagdish Kupchandani and Dr. Fred Koster. Both are physicians and researchers, and both are experts on the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Jagdish Kupchandani is professor of public health at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. He holds doctorates in clinical medicine and health education and epidemiology. His current research includes factors that influence public understanding of the coronavirus and acceptance of science-based responses. Those include vaccination and mask wearing. Thank you, Dr. Kupchandani, for being with us again on Coronavirus Update.
Thank you, Dr. Newton.
And Dr. Fred Koster is a recently retired infectious diseases specialist in Albuquerque, New Mexico, immunology and vaccine research with 35 years of clinical infection control and treatment. In the past 50, Dr. Koster has focused on vaccine research in pandemic viruses and severe bacterial infections. Dr. Koster, welcome back to Coronavirus Update. Well,
thank you. Enjoy it.
I'm so grateful to you both for speaking to our listeners when we call on you to help us understand the rapidly changing trends of the coronavirus pandemic, new scientific findings and public policy changes to equip people to make wise decisions for themselves and their communities. Let's begin with a kind of overview. Pandemic trends currently. What is happening globally, nationally, and here in New Mexico? Dr. Kupchandani, could you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I think part of it is how we view the global trends. Some people have started assuming that the pandemic is behind us. Some are still in the midst. And some people are anticipating still worse future. I think what we have to look at is global vaccination rates, new cases, deaths, and variants of concern. So I don't think we are still in a good shape, in part because a large part of the world is not vaccinated. In the United States, we're still struggling. The flu season is ahead of us. Hospitals are overwhelmed. So it does seem like we have not learned enough lessons and we are back to the stage that we were in, maybe in winter last year.
That's true, I would think, of the nation as a whole. We have some states where currently the daily infection rates seem to be dropping. I think New Mexico is one of those, and yet here in Grant County, just this week, our local newspaper reported that we seem to be several weeks behind the trend of the state, and we have had an increasing surge of new infections and a distressing increase in deaths recently. So what is there to be learned from the uneven patterns with some states, particularly those with a very high proportion of unvaccinated people showing surges, and some other areas showing what looks like a decrease in the spikes that they were having?
Yeah, I think it indicates a clear trend of how vaccination rates correlate with hospitalizations and deaths, not with infection. So, you know, the idea of a vaccine is to see how the rate of vaccination decouples infection with hospitalization and death. And unfortunately, southern United States struggled with vaccination, and now they are overwhelmed with patients in hospitals. So, you know, even from a surface, for a person who has some common sense, you would see rate of hospitalization versus rate of vaccination in a state. There's a clear inverse relationship. And, you know, now it's sad to see some people running for vaccines when they know family members who have died, or people in the ICU asking for a vaccine. And it's just that, you know, nature of what we are looking at in a pandemic, we have allowed the virus to dominate our own beliefs and value systems, and it's continuing to do what it's supposed to do.
We will come back to specific questions having to do with vaccination issues. Dr. Koster, thinking back about the patterns of the coronavirus pandemic last year and what's known at present, because you researchers are constantly learning about this rapidly changing environment, what do epidemiologists, virologists, public health experts expect for the year ahead?
Well, many epidemiologists will give you the short answer, and that is, we don't know. There are models out there that that say that we're going to begin to see in this country slow decreases in numbers of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths that will kind of bottom out in March of next year, 2022. That's what the modeling consortium, when they look at all the factors. But as Jagdish has said, this is a very bumpy path for every part of the country. The South, particularly the Southeast, is hurting right now. States in the Northwest, Idaho and Montana are hurting. And that's where the vaccine really comes in. In terms of the long term, I think a lot of particularly virologists will say, you know, I don't know, because I don't know what's going to happen with not only the Delta. The Delta may slowly decrease over time, but what is going to replace it? And, you know, we have three new variants that are spread around the country. It's too early to say what, in fact, their potential will be in terms of spread, because you can't look at mutations in a virus and then say, oh, it's going to be worse or not as bad as Delta, this sort of thing. Can't do that. You have to see how the spread happens amongst the unvaccinated. And so everybody is kind of holding their breath. It's a very hard thing for the public not to be able to anticipate an end to this mess. But we have to deal with what we know and what we don't know.
And as you both told our listeners in our past interviews, it is very difficult to predict what will happen with viruses because the mutations are random. Most of them are failed mutations. Some can produce a new variant like the Delta that becomes more powerful, more perilous, which is why I use the word expect rather than what will happen. Let me ask you, and we will come back to some particular focus, not only on vaccines, but on the variants that you referred to, Dr. Koster, but practical guidance in a nutshell for our listeners right now, because now is when people do have to make decisions about how they will behave, where they will go, what they will do, what kinds of precautions to take. I'd like to ask each of you, not necessarily to repeat one another, but to give your perspective on reasonable, practical COVID safety procedures and practices for individuals, for households, for groups, and for businesses, for churches, for places where people back in what used to be normal would congregate. Dr. Kupchandani.
You know, I have just one suggestion: get vaccinated and try to maintain distance from people and keep masking up no matter where you are. The moment you go out of house, unfortunately, because of the collective failure of humanity in this pandemic, we have to continue on this path for some more time.
And would you say outdoors as well as indoors, people should be wearing masks around each other, even if they're a little distant from one another?
Yeah, outdoor, I think there's lesser chance of spread. But, you know, again, how do we define outdoor? Is it like going to a grocery store? So, I've become so risk averse now that I want no one at risk. And so continue to wear a mask as long as you are inside a closed, congregated setting and the moment you go out of house.
Thank you. And Dr. Koster?
Yeah, I think in terms of the distancing, it's been shown that it takes about 10 minutes standing next to somebody, whether you're indoors or outdoors, but you're right close that and you're talking, that transmission can occur, not necessarily occur, but can occur. And so that's a situation. I think when you're outside and you're passing people on the street or, this sort of thing, I think that the risk is very low. And but indoors, particularly in areas where the ventilation is poor, their masking and some distancing is still in order.
And I think what I'm hearing from both of you is that if one is in doubt at all, for example, we're not in control necessarily of when we'll encounter people and where we'll encounter them, be safe, put that mask on. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, also the kind of honor system that we were depending on. Now I don't know who's vaccinated, who's not. So I really cannot control that, but I can control myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a related question. Is there a great deal of similarity, I've seen this in some reports, between the capacity of a fully vaccinated person to carry a viral load in her nasal mucosa and respiratory passages, that the vaccines are internal vaccines, they are not mucosal vaccines, and does that mean that there really isn't a great deal of distinction between the possibility that a person who is fully vaccinated but has just spent 15 minutes in close conversation unmasked with an infected person might pass that infection around despite being fully vaccinated? Are fully vaccinated people less likely to carry the virus to others than people who are not vaccinated? Dr. Koster, your years of research in virology, can you speak to that, please?
Yeah. They are a lot less able to transmit the infection. And it's because of the viral load issue. And that, just to throw out some numbers, and these numbers vary a lot, and they're going to vary from person to person, but so don't take them as gospel. But after vaccination, you get exposed, your PCR test is positive, your antigen test is negative. And there's only going to be at most 100 to 1,000 particles in the throat or mouth, wherever the swab is taken. Whereas if you are unvaccinated and you're PCR positive and you don't yet have symptoms, or symptoms will come in a day or two, now we're talking about a million, maybe 10 million virus particles in the mouth. So while, you know, we measure the antibody in the blood, okay, it does get translated, carried through the mucosal membranes into the throat and whatnot, kills the virus. That's what neutralizing antibody does. And so the statements that have been made recently about, well, a vaccinated person is just as likely to transmit the infection as a unvaccinated person is wrong. That's not correct.
Thank you. That is some comfort and yet more encouragement to people to be fully vaccinated. Let me ask a specific vaccine recommendation question, and then I want to move on to ask about young people and their vulnerability to infection. Vaccine recommendations. Boosters are now available to some groups of people, or will soon be. So who should really get a booster? And what is your advice on vaccinations for children 12 to 17? Those have been available for some time now, but newly children 5 to 11. So let me ask you first about Dr. Kodani.
Yeah, there has been a lot of movement at the FDA, the CDC, recently in the past 1 week. And it does make sense that if you are above the age of 65, you should get a booster. Or if you are above the age of 50 and you have some underlying medical conditions, go get a booster. It's critical to visit your healthcare provider now, ask for a recommendation. And, you know, I've known some people who were not sure, but above 70, they did not know if they're immunocompromised and they've just gotten to get the booster. Because it's hard to tell on a person's level if they're immunocompromised or not. And there's no harm in getting that booster if it's available.
So if you're 65 or older, do get a booster. If you're 50 to 65, ask your healthcare provider if there's reason to think you're immunocompromised. Dr. Koster, anything to add to that?
I agree with that. The reason that the boosters are now targeted for those over 65 is that as we age, everybody's immune system kind of slows down a little bit. And viral titers drop when you're over 65 a little faster than when you're, you know, less than 65. There's a lot of variation between people. And we hear about people who are fully vaccinated and yet they hospitalized severe illness and even the rare death. Those folks, the few that I know, have actually not made antibody to the vaccine, which is those who have died. And why that is, nobody really knows. They wouldn't have predicted, except that some of those people were over 80. And so maybe they did have a response that faded rather quickly. But the boosters' recommendations do certainly hold water. And if there's any question about it, certainly discuss that with your physician.
Let's turn to the other end of the age spectrum. During the first year or so of the coronavirus, it was really common to hear that children and younger adults were much less vulnerable to this virus, and that if they got infected, their illnesses were much less likely to be serious. And now we're seeing reports, especially in places where there are low vaccine rates, Florida, for example, of pediatric hospitals that are just overwhelmed by seriously ill children, can't care for all the children who need to have ICUs, ventilators. Is there a change in the consensus of medical and scientific opinion on the responses to the virus among young people? Dr. Khubchandani?
Yeah, I don't think the medical scientific practitioners would take this any less serious or more serious. It's the general society, which thought only 500 children have died in the last 1 year. You know, I'm amazed that those 500 did not matter. And we started comparing them with 65 years and older and started saying, oh, we are less vulnerable. I think that that whole approach was wrong. And know the nature of a virus is to spread. Its job is to mutate, and our job was to mitigate. But we, you know, let things happen, and we had different priorities. So I think any sensible medical scientific person would still think of COVID in children as a serious problem and not look at the absolute numbers or relative numbers with older people. But the general society will now have to be awake and think about the virus needs a place to spread. First, it was older, and then it was health professionals. Now it's getting to children, and this will continue.
And so, Dr. Koster, now there are decisions people can make. For some time, vaccination has been authorized for people 12 to 17 years of age. And I believe it's true that this may be an emergency use authorization, but children 5 to 11 now have access to vaccination, do they not? And Dr. Koster, do you think parents would be best advised to have their children 5 years old and older vaccinated? What's your opinion?
Yeah, what's changed from the earlier thinking about, you know, children don't get sick and they have very mild infection, that was all, those opinions were formed when the circulating viruses were the original one from China and from the alpha strain from Europe. And that was true, although, you know, as Jagdish has said, any child dying that can be prevented, you know, is a tragedy. And so with the Delta, what's happened is that the severity, the average severity of infections has moved into the younger age group. So we're now seeing many deaths in the 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, whereas that was quite unusual before. You know, as with any pandemic, and this has happened with flu pandemics and others over history, is that, you have to go with what you know and expect things to change. Okay, they're not going to stay the same, even though we all want to kind of push the easy button and say, well, you know, now we know this, you know, and we'll work off of that. No, this virus has shown us that it can that it can change. So my recommendation would be certainly for those above the age of 12 to get vaccinated. Okay. They have a very low rate of any side effects. There's a lot been made about myocarditis, but the point there is that those who've had it recover in 2 or 3 days. There haven't been long-lasting issues with it. And again, we're talking about 1 in every 200,000 people, so it's very rare. In terms of the children above the age of 2, and I think the Moderna evidence that's coming out now, it goes down to the age of 2. And I think that would be an appropriate level. It depends on what the data is presented to the FDA. But I expect full approval sometime in the month of October and the vaccine being available. And I certainly would strongly recommend my grandchildren to get vaccinated to make it personal. Children tolerate these vaccines very well. And there's a long, long history of that. The side effects that are much talked about, particularly the autism issue, you know, has been that's been disproven over and over again. It was based on fraudulent data. But when the trials still have to happen and show that there are no serious side effects. And as far as we know, and again, so far, there haven't been. So the safety record is very good. So
I'd like our listeners to know that if you've just joined us, this is Coronavirus Update, the interview of September 25th, 2021. On KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and streaming on the World Wide Web at gmcr.org. I'm Jamie Newton with Dr. Jagdish Kuchandani and Dr. Fred Koster. Our broad topic is the coronavirus pandemic. We're exploring current conditions, the implications of new emerging variants, vaccine options, and we will talk about changing and conflicting guidelines from officials and sound recommendations to individuals, families, and communities. Dr. Kuchandani, I think you had a comment you'd like to offer from our last question, please.
Yeah, I think maybe Dr. Koster can affirm that if you have a teenager in the house, it's time to get the teenager vaccinated. Maybe that's a one-line simple statement. Anyone above 12 or the one who has reached teenage and above should get vaccinated. Because with the 5 to 11-year-old, we still are waiting on the vaccine, more approvals. So, Dr. Koster, would it be fair to say your teenager should get vaccinated?
I agree completely.
And let me just ask from a layperson's perspective, is that not, if anything, more important as kids who have had to be at home try to return under whatever circumstances to the classroom, whether they're spaced out, they're in an inside place, and who knows how consistently teenagers will wear their masks when they're around each other. And it's the joy of being in the company of one's friends after a year. So even more important, let's move from that to these difficult to keep track of variants of the coronavirus. The original coronavirus that began the pandemic, the Alpha, now the Delta, others that we hear less about, mu, lambda. Dr. Koster, how are we doing in terms of movement from one bad virus to another virus that seems an even worse mutation? And what might lie ahead from these others that show up now and then in the newspaper?
Yeah. Well, the two variants that have been in the news now more than others are the mu and the lambda, and these are from South America originally. Particularly the one in Peru. Peru has the highest mortality rate in the world, And that would give pause to, you know, saying, well, this is not as bad as Alpha. But how one variant takes over another is not completely known. Any variant that is more infectious than another, for example, Delta, more clearly more infectious than Alpha, and Delta took over all over the world. But where we are with the mu and the lambda and another one now that's spread around the country, it's from Japan, it's called R1. It doesn't have one of these Greek letters in front of it yet, we know that they have mutations. The concern is whether or not these mutations will make the vaccine antibodies against the spike protein less potent. Again, there's this big gap. You can describe all these mutations and you know, show what they can do in the test tube, but the important and only relevant feature is how they perform in the how they spread in the population, general population. And so it's just too early to say what, if any of these three will become a dominant variant. And believe me, a lot of people are looking very carefully at that.
And I understand that the Lambda variant has been more limited to parts of South America, Peru, Venezuela, partly because travel has been limited. And so it reminds one of other potentially very frightening pathogens like the Ebola, where if they get out of a perimeter, then suddenly many, many poor people are vulnerable. Dr. Kupchandani, I know that you pay particular attention to some parts of the world where there are lots and lots of people, very few of whom have access to vaccines and health care and monitoring, so that it's hard to know what's happening. Can you comment on, from that perspective, on the changes that we're seeing in these variants?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there has been some controversy that it's a pandemic of unvaccinated people, whether it's because they don't have a vaccine or they don't want to take it. But it does seem like we are in some stage of collective failure acknowledgement that worldwide we don't have enough vaccines. There are places where we have vaccines, people don't want them. You know, I wish to raise the example of Denmark. They had the vaccine and they controlled the pandemic to a large extent. And the foundation was trust in each other and trust in their own society and the government. I think beyond what we have as tools to fight medications and vaccine, what we are missing globally is trust, and there's huge divide and misinformation. I just think it's become a more sad world. People have a tough time trusting their neighbors, authorities. But Denmark has created that example that beyond the vaccine, you also need trust in the people. And then once you have that collective sense of responsibility, you can leave the pandemic behind sooner, or at least this virus will become endemic. So I think the United Nations General Assembly is meeting right now. People around the world are joining President Biden. I think they should seriously focus on how to vaccinate the whole world and continue to expand testing facilities. That should be their top priority before economy and other issues that they're dealing with.
And so I think what I'm hearing there is that a good part of overcoming this pandemic is not so much up to science. It's about what people do and how we think about one another and care for one another. Let's consider next, this may be a very short question and answer, but I know some people wonder, Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, is one of these better than the other? If I have an opportunity to be vaccinated with one or the other, is there anything to guide my choice, or should I, once I decide to be vaccinated, take the first one that's available? Either one of you speak to that? Dr. Koster, perhaps?
Yeah, there have been different a number of studies that have shown, you know, these small changes and one titer is better than another and this sort of thing. But in the long run, it really doesn't make any difference. Now, I would recommend for those who had the J&J, a second dose of J&J is an excellent booster, even given months after the first. It really brings the protection up higher than the other two. So and it also doesn't make any difference what the interval is. I know with the Pfizer, it was originally had to be 2 weeks, you know, and now people are saying, well, you know, so what if it's 4 weeks? So if it's 6 weeks, doesn't really make any difference. Okay. Can you have a Moderna first and a Pfizer second? Yes. So it's for those vaccines that are available in this country, they're effective for Delta. Pardon me. the Delta is protected against by our three vaccines, it's behooving everybody to think of themselves and their family and their closest people. That is the best reason to get a vaccine.
Dr. Khubchandani nodding. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think worldwide, if we have audience worldwide or other places, when I got the vaccine, I actually was a scavenger. I was in a parking lot and they had the one last dose and I took it. Because, you know, when you are desperate, you don't look at choices of food, you just eat. And I think we are in such a desperate phase in the world that any country, any person, whatever you get around you, take it because it has been approved, gone through the trials. The idea is to get some amount of protection and follow the course, like complete your full doses, whatever is recommended. Don't just run away after one dose. We've had that challenge worldwide that people had one dose and didn't show up for the second one.
Let me ask a question that I've asked before, but I think it's worth revisiting. The phrase natural immunity, a result of infection. Dr. Koster, you have previously spoken to the comparison, the level and durability of immunity that is given to a person by being infected by the coronavirus as compared to the level and durability of the immunity that comes from full vaccination with any of the three approved vaccines. And I'd like you to revisit that and also with it the risks of COVID infection as compared to the risks that may be associated, that some people think are associated with being vaccinated. Dr. Koster?
Yeah, there are several parts to your question. And in terms of what was the first part of the question was?
The first part of the question had to do with comparing so-called natural immunity that one gets by getting sick or at least carrying the infection, regardless of how symptomatic one becomes, as compared to being vaccinated.
Oh, okay, so I'll take that first. Natural immunity does arise from infection, but in terms of its potency, it depends on how severe the infection is. If you have, a moderate infection with fever for 4 or 5 days, you lose your taste and smell, you feel lousy, you have a headache and whatnot, but may have very minimal pneumonia, okay? That's considered a sufficient infection to stimulate very good natural immunity. Yet we still recommend probably 2, 3, 4 months after that infection to get one vaccine shot. Okay, that gives you about as good a persistent immunity now that we have data going out 10 months as two vaccine doses, and maybe even a little bit better. Okay. On the other hand, if you just had, you were exposed, you had a positive PCR test, but the antigen test was negative, or you felt a little you know, a little off for a day or two and your test was positive, that kind of very mild infection seems to generate poor lasting immunity. You may have, certainly will have antibody for a period of time, but some studies show that will fade over a period of weeks and months. So, again, having the booster after that infection will provide much better immunity.
Thank you, Dr. Foster.
People shouldn't feel that, well, just because they had the infection, now they have natural immunity. The problem is it doesn't last.
And so that vaccination, if you haven't had a vaccination before and you get sick, a few months later you're saying a vaccination effectively acts as a booster.
Yes.
Yes, good. Dr. Khubchandani, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Dr. Koster. You know, you'd have to be seriously infected in the past to develop some type of natural immunity, which could fade off. So we have 40 million people in the United States who were infected in the past 1 year. And now it's estimated that 10 million of those people out of 40 million have no immunity left from the prior infection. Because almost in a quarter of the cases, they were not even seriously infected to have any immunity. And those are the people who should never, you know, avoid a vaccine, just go get vaccinated. Your prior infection is offering you no protection.
And let me ask about an idea that was raised by people I know personally, a couple, one partner did get infected with the coronavirus, that was confirmed, and did have symptoms, moderate symptoms. The other partner attempted to pick that up from the partner who was sick, borrowed that partner's toothbrush, tried to get infected as a form of natural vaccination. Dr. Khubchandani, is that a wise course compared to getting one of the three FDA-approved vaccines?
Yeah, I don't know what is happening with people trying to infect themselves, or it just seems so odd. Like, you know, I use a perfume and I cannot assume my wife will like it too. She may have a serious allergic reaction and end up dying. And it's just strange. You know, vaccines have been shown to be effective in long-term protection, and that should be the way to go.
Dr. Koster?
Yeah, it's you're playing the lottery, kind of a negative lottery. If you can assume, when you assume that your infection is going to be a moderate one that gives you good natural immunity, because a certain percentage, depending on your age, and for those over 50, you know, you're talking about 1% or 2% go on with very serious infection requiring hospitalization, being on a ventilator, et cetera, and even death. So it's not the kind of lottery that you want to play.
And the vaccinations, you've mentioned some extremely rare undesirable side effects, but compared to getting yourself infected and sick, trivial. Yes, Dr. Khubchandani.
Yeah, and you know, the comparison doesn't get better. As of today, we have 40 million people confirmed tested positive in the United States with COVID-19. 700,000 have died. In contrast, we have 100 million people vaccinated. How many have died of vaccines? Less than 5,000. And we are still investigating. So I don't know what could be a better comparison, have a vaccine or get COVID, which is better.
Very compelling odds. We have only a few minutes left. I'd like to ask Dr. Khubchandani to speak about vaccine hesitancy. You have done research on that, and the particular question I'd like to ask you is whether you have seen any diminishing of vaccine hesitancy as more people have become seriously ill and died. And in particular, I remember both of you were hopeful, I think, several months ago that when full authorization by the FDA took the place of the emergency use authorization, that people who had been reluctant to be vaccinated because they thought emergency must mean it's not well enough researched would now feel more confident. Do we see, Dr. Khubchandani, a decline in vaccine hesitancy and even outright resistance to being vaccinated?
Yeah, after the full approval, You know, surprisingly, many Hispanic and African American people have now gotten the vaccine, which is still being investigated how that happened. Could it be because they're dying at a higher number in the South, or is it the full approval? You know, the bigger challenge is when we have those new pieces of evidence, like a full FDA approval. For a layperson like me, it may mean nothing. So, you know, we have a sort of an information marketing problem as well. Like global health crises are also an information crisis, and people like you in the media, I don't know how we explain it to people. What does a full approval mean? And maybe we need to put sustained effort to translating that information into the public. But overall, as a nation, I think we are 36th around the world in percent vaccinations and still trailing behind. Many countries are doing better. So comparison-wise, I think we have a lot of room to improve. But yeah, the full approval did guarantee some assurance to racial minorities. But, you know, again, those spikes are modest. And for some time, like with the vaccine lotteries, for 2 weeks, we had sustained increase in vaccination rates, and now they have dropped down again. So the idea is we have to continue to engage with people using all kinds of tools that we have in our toolkit. In our last study, we found that, it was published last month, that knowing someone who was infected or knowing someone who died increased vaccine acceptance. But that's an unfortunate place to be in, that you have to wait for someone to die to be seriously thinking about a vaccine. So maybe some amount of fear techniques can also be used. We have given enough carrots. We have talked enough about vaccines. Maybe some more facts about COVID could help now, especially when the attention is dwindling.
Mm-hmm. Well, we may have a natural experiment with respect to the carrots and sticks. I noticed that one of the major airlines was imposing a $200 per month fee on its employees if they chose not to be vaccinated. Another of the major airlines was giving a bonus to employees who chose to be vaccinated, and we can see what happens with that. We have so little time left. I would like to ask finally if either of you can comment on confusing guidelines. There are confusing guidelines that come out sometimes from the same agency at different times. The CDC has put out recommendations or requirements and then altered them. And then I think the more persistent problem, people with similar positions, let's say governors, in one state, they will advocate and sometimes impose very strict mandates. You must wear a mask outdoors as well as indoors, for example. And in other states, governors are attempting to punish, say, school superintendents and principals who want to require all of their employees and their children to wear masks. So how do people navigate this confusion? Dr. Koster?
Yeah, public health executed. It's the work is done in a local, as a local activity. Because at a national level, there's so much difference between regions of the country, and even at the state level, there's a lot of variation in terms of whether COVID is exploding or has been controlled, et cetera. And so I don't listen to the national recommendations so much. Okay. Now, obviously, when you're talking about a treatment or a vaccine, okay, that's available to everybody, that does have to involve the federal government in terms of the safety, because you're talking about giving something to everybody. And there's still some levels of debate over, for example, an antiviral drug that is most effective against COVID. Remdesivir is different studies show a little different effects, but it's the FDA and the CDC to make these recommendations to the states, to the insurance companies, to physicians about whether this is safe or not. Those are, of course, recommendations. Mandates that come down from companies, from states, from national offices are in a different category than recommendations. And I think that's where a lot of the friction arises.
Dr. Khubchandani, let me ask you to respond to that as well. And in particular, with attention to the issue of trust, you mentioned Denmark, and their progress was less a result of having access to greater resources than we do in the United States than it was of a matter of believing in one another. And your research has included a focus on people who historically have been given very good reason to distrust those who by right and by law should be concerned with protecting all of us, including the people who are the most vulnerable. So let's make this our concluding comment as we get to our time limit. Please, Dr. Khubchandani.
Yeah, just a quick two quotes. You know, good leaders don't react, they respond. And we always have to be proactive in a pandemic. What CDC has done in the past 2 years, who would trust them now? You know, this past summer in May, they were all about removing the mask mandate based on an honor code that vaccinated people will now remove the mask, unvaccinated will continue to wear a mask. You don't do those kinds of things as a reaction to escalating vaccination rates. So I think they failed a bunch of times. And it's hard for someone like me to look at their daily website guidelines and changing, flip-flopping. In May, they were supposed to reinstate the mask mandate. They said, no, we'll not. Now in July, they're back to the mask mandate. So purely reaction, not response, and then not having foresight and not being proactive and just reacting to situations daily. That's not how they should behave, especially when they're dealing with large populations worldwide. People look up to CDC, but the trust has gone.
And so, not to end on too low a note, I'd just like to reiterate that both of you have encouraged our listeners, if at all in doubt, take protective steps. As you put it, Dr. Khubchandani, when you step out of your door, put on your mask, maintain your distance, take precautions. You've been listening to the Coronavirus Update interview of September 25th, 2021. My guests have been Dr. Jagdish Khubchandani, Professor of Public Health at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, and Dr. Fred Koster, a recently retired infectious diseases specialist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you both for returning to Coronavirus Update. This interview will be posted for listening and downloading at your convenience on the Coronavirus Update page of our website, gmcr.org, and also on the comprehensive resource website, grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org, a collaboration of a group of community organizations in Grant County. Once again, on our own page, gmcr.org, and on the Grant County CoronavirusUpdate.org webpage. Thanks, as always, to Marcus Hansen, our station manager, audio engineer, and producer of Coronavirus Update. This community station is made possible entirely by donations from listeners and supporters. Please visit gmcr.org and click the big donate button to contribute using PayPal or a credit card, or you can bring or mail a check payable to GMCR. That's GMCR. To 519B North Bullard Street in Silver City, New Mexico, 88061. For more information, call 575-597-4891. That number again is 575-597-4891. Be safe and be well. Thank you for listening and for supporting this community radio station. For Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, I'm Jamie Newton.